This is The Story of Stores. I'm Charlie Smart.
And I'm Helen Steck.
Believe it or not, there's a day in Yukon history that people who were there for it call Bloody Tuesday.
November 26th, 1968.
Now, it wasn't quite as dramatic as the name makes it sound. Chris Malis was a student at UConn, and he was there for Bloody Tuesday.
One state police officer managed to connect his billy club to one of the leaders of the demonstration. That's where it got its name, Bloody Tuesday.
So there was a demonstration. That much is clear. But why?
Well, it was the late 1960s, and that means...
In Vietnam, American B-52 bombers have struck twice near Saigon.
The Viet Cong continued their struggle for the allegiance of the people.
In which nearly a million men have died.
This is the face of war in Vietnam, yesterday, today, and tomorrow.
So in general, it was a protest against the Vietnam War. But, like most important events, there was a lot leading up to it.
And a lot that happened after. So let's take a step back and look at what was going on at UConn and in colleges across the country back in the mid-1960s.
February 1965, President Lyndon B. Johnson orders Operation Flaming Dart and the United States starts bombing Viet Cong sites in North Vietnam.
This is the first set of retaliatory airstrikes by the United States in the war. Just a year earlier, Congress gave President Johnson the okay to wage war against North Vietnam. So after these bombings, things start to escalate.
Within 2 years, the United States is spending over $22 billion in drafting over 200,000 young men to serve in the war each year.
And a lot of people, especially students, aren't happy.
Students across the country are burning their draft cards in protest of the war and holding teach-ins where they'd sit and talk about the war and the draft.
Colleges across the country were faced with this turmoil, and UConn was no exception.
But before we start talking about that, we should probably get an idea of what UConn was like back then, since this is about 70 years since our last episode.
The store's campus had about 9,000 students in 1967, and its president was Homer Daniels Babbage, Jr.
Maybe you've been to the library named after him?
Babbage was a higher education expert and was UConn's president for 10 years, from 1962 to 1972.
When he first became UConn's president in 1962, he was only 37, making him the youngest president of a state university in the U.S.
His tenure can pretty much be divided into two parts.
From 1962 to 1966, Babbage focused on continuing the land-grant school's transformation into a more liberal arts-focused university.
During his first years on campus, Babbage was widely praised and much loved. Seriously, everyone loved this guy.
At the end of his first year at UConn, John F. Kennedy even invited Babbage to meet with other higher education leaders to discuss civil rights at the White House.
But the second part of Babbage's administration found him challenged by political, cultural, and social changes that disturbed countless college campuses during the Vietnam War.
Now it's perfectly clear that President Babbage will not let us demonstrate nonviolently!
In 1960, a group called Students for Democratic Society, or SDS, was formed, mostly to criticize America's Cold War policy.
But by 1966, they were pretty much only focused on opposing the war in Vietnam.
At UConn, they were independent from the national organization, and they weren't made up of that many students.
George Jacoby was a student at UConn back in the late 60s.
They were what I thought was a small presence at first.
But they started to have a pretty strong influence across campus.
Sidney Gale was a student at UConn back in the late 60s, and he wrote a column for the student newspaper.
Well, one of the non-credit courses that I learned from during my time there was the capacity of a very small but well-organized group to have disproportionate influence.
George Jacoby.
When they would announce a demonstration about something, a lot of sympathetic people would show up. So it immediately looked like a larger SDS presence than really existed.
So what were these people protesting?
Clearly, they were against the Vietnam War, but there were also some specific things at UConn.
A lot of the early protests were directed against UConn's ROTC.
ROTC, Reserve Officers Training Corps, was first established at UConn in 1916. back when the University of Connecticut was still called the Connecticut Agricultural College.
ROTC was, and still is, essentially military training for students.
As opposition to the Vietnam War grew, so did student opposition to the ROTC on the UConn campus.
I grew to believe that anyone voluntarily entering the military under the premise that we were that it was a just and honorable cause was being duped.
On September 21st, 1967, 8 students against the ROTC's presence on campus protested outside the ROTC hangar.
Organizer David Yam told UConn's Connecticut Daily Campus, quote, "The ROTC's main purpose is to provide a training ground for military officers, and I believe that this purpose is incompatible with the ideals for which this university stands."
But these early protests didn't make too big of an impact on campus.
The captain of Air Force ROTC said that, quote, "No one was too disturbed by the picketing."
Later ROTC protests were a little more creative.
We took over the ROTC building and repainted it with all sorts of symbols. That lasted, I think, about 24 or 48 hours, and then it went back to being ROTC.
The other issue, probably the bigger issue, that students were protesting was a certain company recruiting students on campus.
The Dow Chemical Company. See, back then, Dow manufactured the two things that came to symbolize the sheer inhumanity of the Vietnam War: Agent Orange and napalm.
Flying low across the trees, pilots doing what they please, dropping frags on refugees. Napalm sticks to kids.
So, back in the late 60s, Dow and lots of other companies,
all kinds of companies,
were sending recruiters to college campuses.
Like companies still do today.
On October 31st, 1967, 2 Dow recruiters came to campus to interview students.
But the interviews never actually happened, because over 150 students showed up to protest. They lined the hallways of Coons Hall, where the interviews were taking place, and didn't let the Dow reps in.
So the interviews were rescheduled.
But a lot of people, and remember, the SDS made up a very small group on campus, a lot of the other students and faculty thought the protesters themselves were in the wrong.
The student government passed a statement saying that by blocking the interviews, the protesters were infringing on other students' right to free speech.
The Graduate Student Senate said the same thing, and on November 15th, the Board of Trustees made it clear that students in these kinds of protests were, quote, subject to the most severe institutional penalties.
But really, that was the least of the protesters' worries, because of something we haven't really talked about yet.
The draft.
Almost 100 years ago, in 1917, Congress passed the Selective Service Act, which let the president conscript young men to serve in the military.
Most people today, when they think of the draft, think of the lottery. But it wasn't always like that.
There was a system of deferments. Your deferments bumped you down in the order of people who would be called to service.
You could get a deferment for all kinds of things. Being a minister, working in agriculture,
or being a student.
But in October 1967, Draft Chief Louis B. Hershey announced that anyone caught interfering with military recruitment would lose all of their deferments.
So suddenly, they'd be first on the list. But none of that stopped the protesters. Dow came back towards the end of 1968, and protesters lined the halls again. Though, this time, the interviews actually happened.
But that was nothing compared to what happened in November of that year.
Bloody Tuesday.
See, after that last protest, President Babbage decided he needed to discipline the students who were involved.
And that was tough for him. I mean, when you read about him and you see videos of him speaking, you can tell he didn't want any of this.
I mean, after the first protest, he said he was, quote, impressed by the earnestness of the protesters.
But now he didn't really have a choice. And by disciplining the students involved in the protests, in their eyes, he suddenly became public enemy number one.
12 people did get in trouble after the Dow protest, 8 students and 4 faculty members.
The faculty, Charles Brover, David Colfax, John Leggett, and Jack Roach, all faced dismissal from the university.
So to try and help the students and faculty who got in trouble, protesters occupied Gully Hall, where Babbage had his office.
That didn't really do much, and eventually Babbage was forced to call in state police to get the students out.
But that wasn't the last time the state cops were called in.
Tuesday, November 26, 1968, more recruitment interviews were scheduled on campus.
To try and avoid protests, the interviews were held at 7 Gilbert Road.
Over by South Campus.
And the administration tried their best to keep the location a secret.
But about an hour after the interview started, protesters began to show up.
Now, Babish had released a statement saying that anyone on the porch or stairs of the building who wasn't supposed to be there was effectively trespassing.
So when protesters climbed up on the porch and started blocking students from getting into interviews, the police started to respond.
And the protesters started throwing rocks.
And cherry bombs.
And the police were given riot sticks.
And then John Ring, the director of university security, read the riot act.
We ask for attention, we ask for attention, and we will now read the riot act.
So now anyone still in the area was subject to arrest. But not everyone left.
And then the state troopers arrived.
And more than 20 people were arrested.
And see, President Babbage hated all this. He said,
"This is the saddest day of my life. To feel that it is necessary to introduce an element of force on the campus of an institution dedicated to reason and rationality."
There were some more protests that year, but fast forward to 1970.
With tensions already running high,
an event that will probably remain in the minds of young people throughout America for a long, long time. And I'm speaking about the incident in Kent State.
On May 4th, 1970, members of the Ohio National Guard fired into a crowd of Kent State University student demonstrators.
They were initially protesting the expansion of the Vietnam War into Cambodia, but it quickly morphed into a protest against the presence of the Ohio National Guard on Kent State's campus.
Four students were killed and nine were wounded.
At UConn, the Student Senate, SDS, Black Student Union, and United Towers Organization all voted to join the nationwide student strike.
They also endorsed national demands to end the systematic repression of political dissidents, the immediate withdrawal from Southeast Asia, and an end to defense research and ROTC at universities.
The following day, other student groups announced their support of the strike.
The College of Liberal Arts and Sciences faculty also voted to suspend classes for the rest of the semester so students and faculty wouldn't, quote, be denied the opportunity to respond in a constructive way to this ominous situation.
On Wednesday, May 6th, UConn had a day-long metanoia,
a period of active meditation when classes are canceled.
It was about racial respect.
This was planned before the Kent State shootings.
Babbage announced that classes wouldn't be canceled for the strike, but since they were always optional, students could skip them.
But faculty members had a responsibility to students who wanted to continue with their scheduled coursework.
On the day of the strike, a survey found that many students stayed away from classes in the humanities and social sciences buildings.
But attendance was pretty much normal in the sciences and professional schools.
It's estimated that between 4,000 and 5,000 students gathered at the Student Union Mall to hear anti-war activist John Freund speak.
The Student Senate also narrowly voted to abolish the ROTC,
which the University Senate rejected.
On Friday, May 8th, a special meeting of the University Senate voted to continue classes for all students who wanted to attend and forbid penalties for those who didn't attend.
Final exams were limited to whatever was taught before May 5th, and students who chose not to take them could receive an S for satisfactory work completed before May 5th.
But remember, some classes were still going on.
Demonstrators disrupted classes in Vondermaiden Recital Hall and the Social Sciences Building.
They also interrupted an exam in Engineering Building 1.
Chris Malis was one of those students.
The day after Kent State, myself and several other people, some of whom were in SDS, some of whom were not, just anti-war protesters, basically, donned kerchiefs to hide our identity and started looking for classes that were being held. We went into classes and said, "Why are you teaching math today? Math will be here tomorrow," when four American students were just murdered by young American soldiers, National Guardsmen, and nine others were injured, seriously. The kerchiefs didn't do much to hide our identities.
The dean of students identified 15 disruptors, including Chris.
I got a letter saying to report to the dean's office, to the dean of students, to show cause why I should not be immediately expelled from UConn for my actions.
Don't worry, though. Chris ended up just fine.
In my case, I was suspended from UConn, but my suspension was suspended pending me being a good boy for the rest of my time here.
A little after midnight, President Babbage met with the university senate.
Elliot Wolk, head of the mathematics department, said that Babbage brought a bottle of whiskey and asked if the university should be closed.
The executive committee said no, and a presidential newsletter with the message was sent to the student body.
On Wednesday evening, the student senate unanimously passed a resolution expressing, quote, no confidence in the will and ability of President Homer D. Babbage to perform the duties of his position in a manner beneficial to the student community or to the general welfare.
Classes ended on Friday, May 15th.
Final exams began the next week. Some students decided to take them on campus or at home.
Others just took the S grade.
Like many universities across the country, UConn was suffering from the turmoil of the Vietnam War.
Babbage really did his best to keep things peaceful at UConn and listen to what students had to say.
George Jacoby.
We thought he was a nice guy at the time. We just thought he was stuck in a position of authority in a situation that, you know, no one was going to be able to control. How he handled the protests without getting anybody hurt significantly was a real nice job on his part.
He really was well-loved.
But despite his best efforts, he became a symbol for everything the protesters were against.
They were a relatively small group, but very vocal.
And they wanted him out.
And on his ninth anniversary of becoming president, October 1st, 1971, Homer Babbage announced his resignation. He said, quote,
it seems that every time an institution befouls itself, the president is dismissed. We might properly be known as the disposable diapers of American higher education.
Over 7,000 students signed a petition asking him to withdraw his resignation.
So did the university senate.
But Babbage didn't change his mind.
After leaving Storrs, Babbage went back to Yale and became master of Timothy Dwight College.
He even tried running for governor, though he stepped aside for fellow Democratic candidate and eventual governor Ella Grasso.
In 1976, he became president of the Hartford Graduate Center.
And in March 1984, at the age of 58, Homer Babbage Jr. died of cancer.
When he died, UConn's Board of Trustees named the school's new library in his honor.
The Story of Storrs is a production of WHUS Radio at the University of Connecticut. It is produced by Helen Steck and me, Charlie Smart. Special thanks to Sydney Gale, Chris Malice, George Jacoby, and, as always, the wonderful people at the UConn Dodd Center. Music for this episode was provided by Kevin MacLeod, Silent Partner, Huma Huma, the United States Marine Corps Band, Puddle of Infinity, Audionautics, Chopin, and Broke for Free. You can follow us on Twitter. I'm at Charlie R. Smart, and Helen is at H. Steck. If you like this podcast, please rate it and subscribe on iTunes. Next time on The Story of Storrs.
So when these land-grant colleges started, there was usually an emphasis on training farmers and future farmers. And there was an idea that as a complement to that, there would also be training for farmers' wives.